So maybe I'll talk a little bit about the Four Noble Truths, and then we'll do some walking meditation. Wake up, everybody. I won't talk long. And then come back and have time for more sitting and some discussion. So everything within the Buddha's teaching can be encapsulated with, I teach one thing and one thing only, that is suffering and the end of suffering. And the normal formulation of that is what's called the Four Noble Truths. So underneath any reading of metaphysics or cosmology or description, elaboration, lies this question of the importance of recognizing dukkha, or the suffering in life, seeing that it has a cause, believing that it has an end, and following a path to that end, so that it's not a question of holding a kind of remote possibility in mind. Like the other very common thing people say to me, say in New York City, is something like, well, fine for the Buddha sitting under a tree 2,500 years ago in India. It's too bad I live in Manhattan where it's so noisy. You know, if only I didn't live in this place, if only I was more rested, if only I didn't have so much going on, then I could really make progress. So the question of the Four Noble Truths really is about having a map, and the tremendous individual freedom to follow it or not. It's not really a question of admiring it from afar or envying the conditions of the Buddha's life and removing ourselves from that sense of possibility. The whole point is to bring ourselves directly into the center of possibility. So even though it can make people feel a little squeamish, it seems a little self-preoccupied or self-centered, the whole point is ourselves in the best possible way. Because otherwise, it is just like distant admiration, rather than being not only about our own freedom, but what our own freedom means in terms of how we manifest in the world and the degree of compassion and inclusion that, and generosity and patience that we can express because of that freedom. So I sometimes say that when we look at a Buddha image, again from within the context of this tradition, we look at a Buddha who is always described as a human being, who had some very intense questions about the nature of life, and it said everything he discovered through the power of his own awareness, and so can we. So we look at the Buddha to see something about ourselves, about our potential as a human being. And it's not a sense of just like, oh, the Buddha and I, we're great. But when we look at ourselves on that level of that potential, that capacity to love, to be free, to understand our lives, that is a capacity we are said to all share, that is never ever destroyed, whatever we might go through, whatever we might yet go through. As a human being, that capacity is never destroyed. It's perhaps covered over or obscured or hidden from view or hard to trust, but it's there. So we look at the Buddha to see ourselves. We look at ourselves to see all of life, to see all beings everywhere. So it's really, it's all like this transparency of connection. So our work is to open to, acknowledge, understand the truth of suffering in life, our own and others, all those dimensions, to look at the cause. And in this sense, the cause of suffering Classically, it's usually called craving or clinging, sometimes ignorance. It really means being at a kind of odd angle to reality, so that we're not in harmony, we're just not in accord with how things are. And so that particular kind of pain of resistance, feeling betrayed by life, feeling abandoned by life, is caused by this kind of misperception, which comes out in many, many different ways. This feeling like if I hold on tight enough, this won't change ever. If I try to control that person powerfully enough, they'll do exactly what I think they should do forever. If only I had that picture, I would be completely happy forever. Then again, I do need a bigger apartment in order to have a wall that it could fit on, so maybe I need that picture and a new apartment. Then I would be totally happy. Or getting older, being sick, being frightened, dying is humiliating. It shouldn't happen. I should have been more on top of things. There's a way to be in complete control of this universe. I'm kind of not there exactly, but I know there must be a way. If I fret and scream and yell and protest enough, there won't be any more pain. That disagreeable situation will dissolve. I'll always get what I want. Power, strength comes through revenge. That's an interesting one. Or a million other examples of ways we're just kind of off in the way we see things. And so because of that, we try to be in control of what we can't control. We struggle against what we cannot change instead of doing the things we can do, which might include not being so alone in this situation, or relating with compassion instead of hostility, or doing the little bit that we can to try to help, rather than thinking it's not worth it because it's not this giant, enormous contribution, or whatever it might be that kind of just has us be askew, and so we suffer. So craving or clinging or ignorance in this sense is the cause of suffering. The second noble truth is clearly ameliorated by seeing how things actually are, getting in alignment. It doesn't mean giving up, it doesn't mean not caring, it doesn't mean all the many things we might think it means. It means just living in harmony with how things are. And lo and behold, we're a whole lot happier. The third noble truth, the end of suffering, that not that everything flattens out, there's no more airport delays, there's no more disagreeable situation, there's no more tragedy. It's not that. But everything is different because we're different with it all. And so you could say, like, all those extra things we tend to add, the self-blame, the humiliation, the anger, the fear, the clinging, the seeking to be in control, none of that needs to be there. And so that's what starts to relinquish, even as we go up and down, just in the ordinary course of a day or a life. I mean, inevitably that happens. So there is an end to suffering that is very real, day to day, immediate, as well as more kind of ultimate. And then there is the path, the fourth noble truth, which is kind of the whole point. that there is said to be a path. This is an experiment, it's an exploration, but it needs to be brought to life to make the experiment. You know, rather than standing distantly, perhaps cynically, far away, and saying, well, that couldn't possibly make a difference, or I can't do it, or whatever it might be. The way to make the experiment is to actually make the experiment. So it's like we are our own laboratory as we see, well, what happens as we kind of see our lives themselves as our creative medium. What happens if, I mean, one of the elements of the Eightfold Path, which we'll, you know, we'll talk about when we come back from the walking, has to do with right speech, or some people don't like the word right, and they have other ways they translate that, but again, I'm so old-fashioned. So common old-fashioned translation is right action, right speech, and so on. So right speech includes not lying. And that's an interesting experiment to make. What happens when you really try to speak the truth in a skillful way in your life? What happens when you don't? Paying attention to that as well. What does that feel like? What are the consequences to that? What happens when you next run into that person? You know, or whatever it might be. So one's whole life becomes this avenue of exploration.